Hello, how you doing? Hiya, thanks for coming along this evening. My name's Derek McIntyre, and what we're going to look at tonight and the next two nights, and the next two Tuesday nights, is Jesus the Evidence. Is that on the loud side? Okay. So, let's just get going then. So what we're going to do? Well, I'm going to start by making two statements. There's a historical and rational basis for Jesus being the Son of God, and there's a wealth of evidence to support this view. Historical and rational basis for Jesus being the Son of God, and a wealth of evidence to support that. And the purpose of this short course is to review and discuss this evidence. So to give you a bit of information about what we're going to do, there's three sessions, as I said. Each session was about a 40-45 minute presentation, followed by an opportunity to discuss and ask questions. Now, there's no set overall time for each session, but we're guessing that each will last around about 1 to 1.5 hours, depending on the number of questions. So who's this course for? Well, as you'll have seen from the flyers and the advertising, the course is primarily for people who would classify themselves as either agnostics or atheists. So if you're undecided... In a minute. If you've decided if Jesus is the Son of God, or undecided if Jesus is the Son of God, if you don't know if there is a God, then this course is hopefully for you. Or if you're an atheist, and you don't believe in Jesus or don't believe in God, but are interested in hearing the other side of the argument, then this course may also be for you. But we've also found that this course has been useful for Christians. If you're a Christian and are interested in finding more about the historical and rational aspects of your faith, then this course might be of some use to you too. So why are we learning this course? Well, I think you might be surprised by some of the information that we're about to discuss over the next three evenings. This information is all in the public domain, but it's rarely heard either inside or outside church circles. I know from personal experience it can be difficult to find this information. People generally don't know where to look. And if they do look, they might be put off, as the information can sometimes be written in a kind of church language or buried in Christian books and pamphlets that non-Christians can have difficulties with. Also, we live in rational and secular times. Most people today don't just believe in something because they're told to believe by their friends, family, politicians, or the church. Today, we require the facts before we make our mind up about anything. If you've ever looked into the claims that Jesus is the Son of God, you'll find that much of the discussion is centred around faith and belief. Now, as you'd probably expect me to say, there's nothing wrong with faith and belief. However, for the average non-believer in the 21st century, this often presents a difficulty. Well, why believe is the question many people would ask. Often the answers to this question are provided in terms of faith and in a church language that seems out of step with the rest of the world. This course aims to take another approach. Started the evening by saying that there's a wealth of evidence to clearly demonstrate that Jesus is the Son of God. Our aim is to present this evidence in as clear and as rational a way as possible. Lastly, we're presenting this course because I think it's important that people have the opportunity to explore Jesus' message and experience the positive effects that this brings. An atheist friend said to me recently, referring to the Bible, "Of course, Derek, I think it's all just fairy stories." Now, if you've got similar views about Jesus and have no strong evidence to suggest that things are otherwise, then you'll never have the opportunity to experience the positive effects of Jesus' message. Our hope is that this course will give you food for thought and encourage you to explore further. Now, there are many professionally produced courses available on Jesus and Christianity. You may have heard of the Alpha course, or there are many others as well. For example, Christianity Explained, the Why course, Journeys, and so on. However, most of these courses are excellent. Indeed, I've been on an Alpha course myself, and I think you've run Alpha courses here at this particular church. However, none of them looks at the evidence for Jesus in a manner I felt was appropriate for agnostics and atheists. So, to address this, I developed this course myself originally Cathcart Trinity, on the south side of Glasgow. Although the course was developed at Cathcart Trinity, we've adapted some of the structure from two books. One, The Case for Christ by Lee Strobel, and The Jesus Inquest by Charles Foster. Both ask the hard questions many people have regarding evidence for Jesus. Both books also give a fair hearing to the alternative non-Christian interpretations of the available evidence. The book on the left, The Case for Christ, was published in 1998. In it, Lee Strobel draws upon his experience as a former legal reporter for the Chicago Tribune newspaper and the questions he had regarding Jesus when he was an atheist. He interviews a variety of academics, doctors and theologians, and he puts to them the hard questions most people have on Jesus being the Son of God. The Jesus Inquest was published in 2006. The author, Charles Foster, is a barrister and is therefore used to presenting cases in a persuasive manner in the London courts. His job often involves him arguing cases where he may not necessarily agree with the client. In the Jesus Inquest, he takes the case both for and against the resurrection and attempts to argue both cases as effectively as he can. He then leaves the reader, the jury if you like, to make up his or her own mind. So why am I presenting this course? Well, I'm a Christian. However, I used to be an agnostic. Now, like many people, I thought about and discussed religious matters with my friends in my teens, but really never came to any clear conclusions. I suppose I kind of parked the big questions on God and Jesus in a file at the back of my head with a view to thinking about them later, but never did. So through my 20s and 30s, I guess I had the view of many people in the UK today that I really didn't know what to think about God and Jesus. I suppose I thought you probably needed to have some form of faith to be a Christian, and that this faith was for other people, people that had been perhaps brought up Christians, or perhaps people who had experienced some form of life-changing spiritual experience. Neither situation applied to me. However, in my late 30s, I thought it might be worthwhile revisiting some of the questions I'd left unresolved in my teens. My thoughts were that there are plenty of capable and intelligent people who profess to have some form of belief in God. For example, scientists like Albert Einstein and Stephen Hawking, politicians like Nelson Mandela, military men like Norman Schwarzkopf and Richard Dannett, and so on. In a survey in Nature back in 1997, 4 out of 10 scientists said they believed in God. Okay, just over 45% said they didn't believe, and 14.5% described themselves as doubters or agnostics. However, a figure of 40% surprised me. Well, why did they believe? Also, if I looked at the religious leaders in this country, they're clearly not stupid men and women. If these people had some form of belief in God, then perhaps it was worthwhile looking at this again to find out why. Now, at this time, I happened to meet a colleague on a business trip to the USA, who it turned out also happened to be a Christian. I wasn't aware of this until I asked him where he'd been on holiday that year, and he replied that he'd been over to Oxford in the UK on missionary work. As you might imagine, that sparked my curiosity and the conversation turned to matters Christian. The upshot of the conversation was that he said that he'd send me a few books that might help with the questions I had. Sure enough, 2 weeks later, I received a package containing a copy of The Case for Christ, the book I described previously, and a Bible. Now, did reading The Case for Christ turn me into a Christian? Well, frankly, no, it didn't. But what it did do was act as a starting point for my own investigation into who Jesus is. I was amazed by what I found. I was amazed at my own ignorance of the evidence I found. How could I be living in a Christian country and not be aware of this stuff? So the reason I'm presenting the course is that I kind of think it's important to share the information I found with others and allow them to draw their own conclusions. So just before we get started, as I said, three parts to the course. Tonight, and a bit the following week, we'll have a review of the historical evidence for Jesus. What we'll then do is have a wee look at Jesus as he's presented in the historical evidence. And finally, we'll have a review of the evidence relating to the resurrection. So, let's get cracking. So, the historical evidence. So, I suppose the first thing we should perhaps do is have a think about what are the sources of evidence for Jesus? And I suppose we've got the four Gospels in the Bible, the apocryphal Gospels, which we'll talk about a little bit later, The letters of Paul in the Bible, written sources from outside the Bible, dated to shortly after Jesus' life, archaeological evidence, and circumstantial evidence. Now, of these, I think possibly the most overlooked is the last point, circumstantial evidence. I'd like to ponder this briefly. Christianity has existed on this planet for a very long time. Christianity has more followers today than any other religion on earth. However, we know that there was a time when there were no Christians on this planet at all. So, why are there Christians today? Rational cause and effect tells us that at some point in the past, something must have happened, some cause, that had the effect of compelling some people who weren't Christians to become Christians. Now, this might sound like stating the obvious, but for all of us, atheists, agnostics, Christians, those of other faiths, this provides a direct challenge. Cause and effect tells us that the start of Christianity is a historical event. As a result, when and why Christianity started can be studied like any other historical event. Historians of all faiths, or of no faith, have been doing this thing for centuries. The key point we must not lose sight of is that something happened to cause all the Christianity we see all around us today. Something happened to start it all in the first place. And given all the historical research that's been directed towards finding out what happened, all of us, you, me, everybody out there, can come to our own informed view of what we think happened. So what we'll now do is we'll look at each evidential source in turn. However, before we do that, we should maybe ask one fundamental question. Well, did Jesus ever exist? Now, in the past, people have often asked the question as to whether Jesus existed at all, and I hope I'm not brushing this question aside when I say that nearly all contemporary historians, that's Christian and non-Christian alike, are agreed that he did live and die in first century Judea and Palestine. There really is overwhelming evidence, some of which is presented in this course, to back it up. So we're taking this one as a given. It would be a very, very short course if we didn't, frankly. So, if historians agree that he existed, well, what view of Jesus do they agree on? Well, a few years ago, I read a book by the historian E.P. Sanders called The Historical Figure of Jesus. And that's the copy of the book up, and the front cover of the book up on the right-hand side there. Now, E.P. Sanders is regarded as a leading figure in research on the historical Jesus. This particular book was written in 1993. Now, in the book, Sanders gives a brief overview of what the majority of contemporary historians agree upon regarding the historical Jesus. He says, and to quote directly, that amongst historians, these are almost beyond doubt. And to quote directly, Jesus was born circa 4 BCE, near the time of death of Herod the Great. He spent his childhood and early adult years in Nazareth, a Galilean village. He was baptized by John the Baptist. He called disciples. He taught in the towns, villages, and countryside of Galilee, but apparently not the cities. He preached the kingdom of God, and about the year 30, he went to Jerusalem for Passover. He created a disturbance in the temple area. He had a final meal with his disciples. He was arrested and interrogated by the Jewish authorities, specifically the high priest, and he was executed on the orders of the Roman prefect, Pontius Pilate. Now, I should say that Sanders' list continues after Jesus' execution, but we'll look at that a bit more closely in part three. So, what you see above there is in essence what contemporary historians agree upon. And as I said previously, this includes both Christian and non-Christian historians. As you can see, this list is a pretty comprehensive outline of Jesus' life and death. It also closely matches the events of Jesus' life and death as described in the Gospels. So, perhaps now is the time to look a little bit more closely at the Gospels. Now, when I was an agnostic, not that long ago, I thought that the four Gospels of the Bible were theological texts written hundreds of years after the time that Jesus was supposed to have lived, and that the Gospels we read today were substantially revised and doctored versions of what had probably been written in the first place. In short, they couldn't be used as a basis for historical research on Jesus. What surprised me, and what I surprised to find out, was that the general view amongst historians that specialise in first century Near Eastern studies was very, very different. Now, the main evidence for Jesus comes from the four Gospels in the Bible. These are essentially biographies of Jesus' life, death and resurrection. So, question is, are they documents reliable and accurate descriptions of Jesus? So, we're going to spend a bit of time having a closer look at this to understand why historians take the somewhat variant view to the one I had as an agnostic. So, there are four Gospels in the Bible. They're called the Gospels of Matthew, Mark, Luke and John. These names refer to the authors of these Gospels. Now, whether people called Matthew, Mark, Luke and John actually wrote these Gospels is a matter of historical debate. However, the common view is that Matthew was thought to have been written by one of Jesus' original disciples called Matthew. Mark is thought to have been written by a man called John Mark. John Mark was a companion of Peter, one of Peter's original disciples, also known as Simon or Cephas. Luke was written by a man of the same name. Luke was an associate of Paul the Apostle and was actively involved with Paul in spreading the Christian message through the Roman Empire. The authorship of the book of Acts in the Bible, a history of the early church to around 60 to 65 AD, is also attributed to Luke. John is thought to have been written by one of Jesus' original disciples called John. Just put that back up. Called John. Of all the Gospels, there is most debate amongst historians about the authorship of this Gospel. Now, three of these Gospels, that is the books of Matthew, Mark, and Luke, are quite similar in content. In them, the sequence of events in Jesus' life are similar, and the parables, that is the stories that Jesus used to illustrate teaching points, are often identical. Because of these similarities, these three Gospels are sometimes referred to as the Synoptic Gospels. That is, and synoptic meaning to view at the same time. The fourth Gospel, the book of John, is rather different to the other three in both style and content, and we'll look at this in a bit more detail later. So, as I've said before, the main information on Jesus' life and death comes from the four Gospels. We should now return to the question, are these documents reliable and accurate descriptions of Jesus? Well, the answer comes in part from the dates that the Gospels were written. The conservative view is that the earliest Gospel, Mark, was written around 60 to 70 AD, with the other Gospels about 10 years after, Matthew and Luke, 70 to 80 AD, and John, approximately 90 AD. Now, Jesus was crucified about 30 AD. And as you can see, that leaves a gap of no more than about 30 to 40 years, possibly less, between Jesus being alive and the events of his life being written down. So why are these dates important? Well, 30 to 40 years is a very short time. It's just over half the lifetime in first century Judea and Galilee. I appreciate that mortality rates were higher then. However, when Mark was written, there'd be a good chance that some of the people who had actually seen and heard Jesus would still be alive. In short, there'd still be first-hand witnesses for Jesus' life available to draw upon for information, and possibly more importantly, to challenge what was written down if it was inaccurate. Also, a span of 30 to 40 years doesn't give much time for legends and myths to develop about Jesus. There's a general rule amongst historians that the longer the time span between an event occurring and it being written down, the greater the chance of legendary material being incorporated into the narrative. The 30 to 40 years time span we have with Jesus is, in historical terms, very short. For comparison, the earliest biographies we have of Alexander the Great were written more than 400 years after his death, written by Arrian and Plutarch. These are the biographies that we base our knowledge of Alexander the Great on. Another example that we'll look at later in the second evening is the Great Fire of Rome. We base our knowledge of the details on this event on the writings of Tacitus. Tacitus wrote about the fire in 115 AD, 51 years after the actual events. So from a historian's perspective, there's a very good chance that the Gospels are pretty accurate representations of Jesus' life, given that they were written very shortly after the actual events being described. So, we're in 2009. What can you remember about 40 years ago, the late 1960s? Well, that was Abbey Road was issued in 1969. Harold Wilson was Prime Minister. First man landed in the moon. Easy Rider came out. Kingston Bridge was built. And you could buy a Capri for the first time. Indeed. Indeed. So, perhaps not the best example showing these images of the 60s. We do live in an age of mass communication where images of like these are regularly seen today. There'd be no such images to help first century Jewish Christians remember Jesus. Perhaps a better comparison to their situation would be to think about your own family. Think about what you know of your own family, your mother, your father, your grandparents, aunts, uncles, brothers, sisters, and what they were doing in the late 60s, 40 years ago. Think about what you could write down today about their lives at that time, where they lived, who their friends were, where they worked, what interests they had, and so on. Now, to do this, my guess would be that you would use your own memory, if you were alive at that time, talk to surviving members of your family, talk to friends, and so on. From this, how detailed and accurate a picture could you put together? Now, I guess unless you had famous or remarkable family members, it's unlikely that you would have any written sources to go on, diaries, newspaper articles, and so on. It's far more likely that you would use oral information from friends and family and your own memory. In short, you'd be using the same type of sources that the gospel writers used in the first century to piece together their descriptions of Jesus' life. Now, I think it's fair to say that you could probably provide a pretty detailed picture of your family at that time. I'm sure there'd be some omissions and inaccuracies, but I guess the broad detail would be correct. And I'm also sure that if another member of your family did the same task, there'd be differences in the detail between yours and their biographies, but that they would be broadly similar. In this respect, these differing family histories would be a bit like the four Gospels, broadly similar, but differing in some of the detail. So, are there any accounts of Jesus that aren't life that aren't in the Bible? Well, the answer to that is yes, there are. There are many other accounts, Gospels if you like, of Jesus' life that aren't in the Bible. Most of these other Gospels have survived to the present day and are available for both historians and the general public to read and study. You may have read in the press in the last year about the recently unearthed Gospel of Judas Iscariot. This is just one of many Gospels, such as the Gospel of Thomas, the Infancy Gospel of Thomas, the Gospel of Pseudo-Matthew, etc., and so on and so forth, the Gospel of Peter, and so on. These apocryphal Gospels, as they're known, were written either well into the 2nd century or later. They often contain more fanciful and supernatural accounts of Jesus' life, just as historians might expect from the rule of thumb we were talking about earlier on, about the distance between an event happening and it being written down, for the opportunity for legendary material to weave its way into the narrative. So, these are other Gospels. So who decided which Gospels would be in the Bible? You might wonder, who decided what was in and what was out? Well, the answer is that no one person or church decided. In the 2nd, 3rd and 4th centuries, the central core of the four Gospels and the letters of Paul were accepted by the various Christian churches in the Roman Empire, with other Gospels being accepted in some churches and not in others. Eventually, around 320 AD, possibly at a council in Rome, the current books of the New Testament were decided upon. Interestingly, it was the four oldest Gospels, i.e. the ones written closest to the actual events of Jesus' life, and thus the ones deemed the most reliable, that made the cut. So, are the four Gospels in the Bible the earliest written works of Jesus, with Jesus mentioned? Mentioned earlier on that the earliest Gospel Mark's written 30 to 40 years after Jesus' death. Well, actually, Paul's letters were written earlier than the Gospel of Mark. So, who was Paul? Well, Paul, or Saul as he was known, was a Jew living in Judea around the time of Jesus. He was directly involved in the persecution of early Christians. Some dramatic event occurred in his life to change him from a persecutor of Christ, a Christ follower, should I say, to becoming a Christ follower himself. Once he became a Christ follower, he was actively involved in the establishment and support of Christian churches throughout the Roman Empire. He was eventually arrested and imprisoned in Rome, and he was executed in Rome sometime between AD 60 and AD 70. There's a wee picture showing you the various journeys that Paul made in his journeys to spread the Christian church through the Eastern Mediterranean. So, as part of his work in encouraging the growth of Christian churches, Paul wrote letters to some of these churches. Unfortunately, not all of these letters have survived to the present day. However, those that have survived contain Paul's views on Jesus, guidance on worship, clarification on theological matters, and words of encouragement. They also provide details of some of the issues and divisions existing in the early churches relating to the interpretation of Jesus' teachings and resurrection. And for me, another interesting aspect of these letters is that they are genuine letters with "hope this finds you as it leaves me" type first paragraphs, and, as with all letters, a glimpse of the writer's personality and mind. But are they genuine? And as you can imagine, there is debate amongst historians as to whether these letters were actually written by Paul. Whilst there's debate amongst the authenticity of some of the letters, historians are confident that Paul wrote a letter to the early church in Rome, two letters to the early church in Corinth, a letter to the early church in Galatia, the first letter to the early church in Thessalonica, and a letter to a fellow worker called Philemon. Now, that's not to say that the others are fakes. It's just that there's more debate amongst historians relating to their authenticity. Now, I won't spend a lot of time discussing Paul's letters here, other than to say that they give a clear picture that Christian worship and Christianity was well developed at the time of writing. As we noted earlier, Paul was executed between AD 60 and AD 70. Therefore, his letters must have been written earlier than this, probably around 15 to 25 years after Jesus' death. Now, why are these dates important? Well, these letters give a clear picture of Christian worship and belief being well developed earlier than 15 to 25 years after Jesus' death. One part of Paul's first letter to the Corinthians is worth mentioning here. This letter was written to a newly established church in Corinth. This letter was probably written around about AD 54 to AD 55. Now, the Corinthians were mainly Greeks and Romans who until recently had been worshippers of the Greek and Roman gods. As a result, there were some misunderstandings relating to Jesus' teachings and methods of worship. In this letter, Paul provides the church guidance on these matters. And one part I'd like to quote directly is 1 Corinthians chapter 15, and this is out of the New International Version. So what it says in Paul's letter is that, "Now, brothers, I want to remind you of the gospel I preached to you, which you've received and in which you have taken your stand. By this gospel, you're saved, if you hold firmly to the word I preached to you. Otherwise, you've believed in vain. For what I received, I passed on to you as of first importance, that Christ died for our sins according to the scriptures, that he was buried, that he was raised on the third day according to the scriptures, and that he appeared to Peter, then to the 12. After that, he appeared to more than 500 of the brothers at the same time, most of whom are still living, though some have fallen asleep. Then he appeared to James, then to all the apostles, and last of all, he appeared to me also, as to one abnormally born." So why is that important? Well, as I mentioned before, Paul's letter to the Corinthians is regarded by historians as genuine. The passage we've just seen and heard is also regarded by historians as genuine. In other words, it doesn't look like a later addition. And what it clearly shows is that at least as early as 15 to 25 years after Jesus' death, and most likely earlier than this, the central message of Christianity was the death and resurrection of Jesus and what it meant. The Gospels may have been written shortly after Jesus' death, but can they be used as the basis for a historical picture of Jesus? Are the Gospels really even biographies? Are they not just theological texts written in a biographical style and therefore not real history? I'm not going to spend a lot of time on this question. That isn't because it's unimportant, more because we could spend hours on it. The E.P. Sanders book I mentioned earlier devotes 3 chapters to this very subject. However, I think what I can say is historians are generally of the view that the Gospels are not biographies of Jesus' life. Well, that is in the way that we in the 21st century understand biographies. For example, there are long periods in Jesus' life that aren't described. Mark doesn't have even any information on Jesus' birth and early life. The parts of Jesus' life that are described are those that have some teaching point to make. Thus, the Gospels are, if you like, selective biographies. As a result, historians recommend caution to readers of the Gospels. They suggest that they shouldn't be read like contemporary biographies. However, what historians don't say is that they are completely unreliable fabrications. Most historians, Christian and non-Christian, are of the view that the Gospels, particularly the Synoptic Gospels, it must be said, are accurate enough to be used as the basis for a historical debate on Jesus. So, I appreciate I've been firing a lot of history and dates at you this evening, so I thought at this stage it'd probably be worthwhile drawing breath and summarising what all this information means. Well, there's good evidence that the earliest gospel was written around 30 to 40 years after Jesus' death. There's good evidence that letters describing Christianity were written 15 to 25 years after Jesus' death. Implicit in the letters is the fact that Christianity was growing and that Christians had already a well-developed view of themselves and what they believed. This had all occurred in the 15 to 25 years after Jesus' death. These dates are important because many of the people who had actually witnessed Jesus and the things he did would still be alive to challenge what was written in at least the earliest Gospels and the letters and teachings of Paul. And interestingly, in the Bible there is actually evidence of such challenges. Early on there was some conflict between those Jews who had followed Jesus when he was alive and non-Jews who had converted to Christianity after his death. This conflict centred around the style of worship to be used and seems to have been quite bitter. However, there's no mention of conflict over the details of Jesus' life, death and resurrection. And historians are of the view that the Gospels are accurate enough to be used as the basis for a history on Jesus. In summary, there's a good chance that the Gospels provide a pretty accurate account of Jesus' life, death and resurrection. Well, that's all very well and good, but it doesn't answer another key question. Has this evidence been reliably preserved for us? Typical arguments are, well, 2,000 years is an awful long time. Printing wasn't invented until the 15th century. Prior to that, Bibles were created by monks in dimly lit cells copying from other handwritten Bibles. Surely mistakes would have crept into the Gospels with all this repeated copying. Gospels weren't written in English. Perhaps our Gospels are translations of translations, and therefore a lot of the original meaning has been lost in translation. Punctuation was invented in the 15th century. Prior to this, there was no punctuation in the Gospels. Punctuation was therefore added to the Gospels much, much later, and we know what the effect that punctuation can have, and has a massive effect on the meaning of a sentence. Lynn Truss's description of a giant panda in a recent bestseller, Eat Shoots and Leaves, is a good example. Perhaps we're completely misreading parts of the Gospels as a result of this later addition of punctuation. And what about deliberate alteration of the Gospels? Well, we know how controlling various churches have been over the last 2,000 years. Perhaps the early church modified or airbrushed out certain parts of the Gospels to get rid of the inconsistencies and inconvenient parts. And what about later additions? Could the early church have added parts to the Gospels to make them fit better with church theology? Theology that could have been developed hundreds of years after Jesus' death. Now, these are all valid questions, and I think require considered answers. So what I'd like to do is spend a short time just stepping through each of them. So, are we in the receiving end of copies of copies of copies? And I suppose the answer to that is yes, we are. We do have many surviving gospel manuscripts today that are copies of copies of copies of copies. However, what we also have are very early scraps of gospel manuscripts as well. The earliest fragment that we have is a papyrus fragment of John's Gospel that's been dated to around 100 to 150 AD. There are over 5,000 papyrus gospel manuscripts in Greek. These are of various ages from the 2nd century onwards. We have around 8,000 to 10,000 Latin gospel manuscripts written at various dates. And we have over 8,000 gospel manuscripts in Ethiopian, Coptic, Slavic and Armenian. And what's been found when these manuscripts are studied using a technique known as textual analysis, that's a technique that historians use to compare differing manuscripts on the same subject, is that these manuscripts that we've just described previously are very close in content to each other. There are mistakes and variances, but they generally look very small and look like human error rather than deliberate alteration. And I guess when you think about it, this might not seem so daft, because put simply, the people producing these Gospels were devout Christians. As a devout Christian, you would see that it was of great importance that you copied the Word of God as accurately as you possibly could. To not do so would be failing the God you believed in. The multiplicity of manuscripts also addresses the translation question. Linguists studying the various translations of the Gospels have found close concordance between them. Furthermore, because these early manuscripts exist today, and of course existed in the past, new translations were being created all the time, and the older translations cross-checked for accuracy. To use a contemporary example, the current New International Version of the Bible was written in 1973. The scholars writing it went back to the earliest Greek manuscripts and translated these, thus short-circuiting the possibility of the lost in translation effect. It's quite an entertaining idea that due to a misplaced comma back in the 15th century, we've got a skewed view of Jesus. The reality is a bit more banal. Linguists involved in the creation of modern Bibles are well aware of this issue and therefore take it into consideration when making these Bibles. Now, I guess you can't say that there are no misplaced punctuation marks in the Gospels. However, it's very, very unlikely that it would have any significant effect on the interpretation of the texts. In summary, we can be pretty confident that the Gospels we read today are accurate translations of the earliest manuscripts. There might be some inaccuracies, but the prevailing view of linguists, translators and historians is that they're small beer. Well, what about deliberate modification? And we might be slipping into conspiracy theory territory here. But it is a legitimate question to ask whether parts of the Gospels were added to or modified before the earlier surviving manuscripts were written. The early church could have airbrushed out contradictions and difficult stuff that didn't quite fit with the prevailing theology. And frankly, there were reasons to do so. At that time, there were varying views within the Christian world as to who Jesus was and what his teaching meant. You may have heard of the terms Gnosticism and Arianism. These were views of Jesus and his teachings that were ultimately regarded as heretical by what became the mainstream church, Christian church. Gnostics and Arians drew their views from the same gospels and were used by the main mainstream church, as well as the apocryphal gospels that we talked about earlier on. Once the Gnostics and Arians had been defeated, Wouldn't it have made sense for the mainstream church to modify the passages in the gospel they'd latched onto so that nobody could repeat their mistakes in future generations? Well, I think the best way of responding to the question of deliberate modification is to read the gospels for yourself and make your own mind up. Now, to a non-Christian, this might sound a bit daunting. As an agnostic, I thought the Bible only existed in the King James Version and was full of these, thous, and begats. It was a bit like reading Shakespeare, a worthy thing to do, but you don't actually do it in your spare time. So it was a bit of a revelation for me to read the Gospels in the New International Version, commonly used by Christians today. I actually found it a pleasure to read the Gospels in plain, easy-to-understand English. And there's a couple of examples. There's the King James Version at the top, and there's the corresponding New International Version at the bottom. And I think if you can pick through the King James Version, you'll find that the meaning is pretty much the same as what you've got below. But I think you'd probably be nearly crying after about four pages of the King James Version. So, if you do read the Gospels for yourself, well, what are you likely to find? Well, one thing you will find is that there are a number of apparent contradictions between the Gospels. Indeed, many atheists cite these contradictions as evidence of the unreliability of the Gospels. Here's a few examples. The number of people that find Jesus' tomb empty varies between the Gospels. The detail of the birth narrative varies between the Gospels. There isn't a birth narrative at all in Mark. The order of some of the events in Jesus' life varies from Gospel to Gospel. In one gospel, we find Jesus' mother Mary being told clearly that the child she was about to give birth to is the Son of God. Yet in another gospel, we're told that Jesus' mother and family tried to stop him in his ministry, saying that he was out of his mind. Odd behavior if you knew that your son was God's son. However, there's another way of looking at these inconsistencies. The four gospels were completed at least semi-independently of each other. If they were all completely consistent, wouldn't that look like there'd been subsequent editing to make them consistent? I guess an analogy to this would be like witnesses to an event like a car crash or a bank robbery. Later in court, the various witnesses to the robbery take the stand and promise to tell the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth. However, the witnesses' testimonies often vary in detail based on what they remember and their own viewpoint or perspective. Usually, though, the witnesses will agree on what generally happened. An example of this is the shooting of Jean-Charles de Menezes in the London Underground back in 2005. Now, I don't know if you remember what you were doing or what you were hearing when it happened, but I remember listening to the radio just after it happened, and a number of people who had witnessed the chase and the shooting were interviewed by the news reporters. You might also remember how confused the initial picture of what happened actually was. However, after a few days, a consensus picture of the events developed. Barrister Charles Foster pithily summed this up from his own court experiences when he wrote, "If every witness to a road traffic accident says the same thing, you know that you're dealing with an attempt to defraud the insurance company." The Gospels, particularly the synoptic Gospels of Matthew, Mark, and Luke, read a bit like this, agreeing in nearly all the details but with a few inconvenient discrepancies. And here's the point. These discrepancies have survived into modern Bibles, the modern Bibles of today. Why? Because they haven't been taken out by the church, or anyone else for that matter. Indeed, when you start to consider this, another question arises. If the early church wanted to airbrush out all the inconsistencies, why not boil all the four Gospels down into one seamless narrative? They could have. Why didn't they? Why have four separate biographies? There's no rule to say the Bible had to contain all four. I'll leave that question hanging for a minute or two. Also, if you read the Gospels, you'll also come across some rather difficult bits that can be hard for Christians to either deal with or to explain. Here are a few examples that I was surprised to find when I read the Gospel of Mark for the first time. Mark chapter 6, verse 5, it says that Jesus could do few miracles in Nazareth. The church teaches that Jesus is God and therefore all-powerful. How then could he have difficulties performing miracles in Nazareth? Mark chapter 13, verse 32, Jesus says that he doesn't know the day and hour of his return to earth. If Jesus was God and therefore omnipresent, existing in the future, in the past and the present, why would he say such a thing? Mark chapter 7, verse 27, Jesus refers to non-Jews as dogs. Hardly a flattering description, particularly as it's those dogs who are Christians today. In Mark chapter 11, verse 12, we find Jesus talking to a fig tree. Indeed, he's cursing it for not having any fruit on it. You remember the flack Prince Charles received when he admitted talking to his plants some years ago. In Mark chapter 15, verse 35, Jesus cries out when he's on the cross, my God, why have you forsaken me? Is this not a strange thing for Jesus to shout if he knows he'll shortly join his Father in heaven? This sounds more like Jesus believes he's been abandoned on the cross by God. Now, there are explanations for these passages. To take the first one, for example, Jesus always linked spiritual and physical healing with a person's faith in him. The people in Nazareth had little faith in him, probably because he'd grown up there and people couldn't see him, see beyond him being Joseph the carpenter's son. As a result, Jesus did a few miracles there. However, rather than try and find explanations for these passages, wouldn't it have been just simpler to remove them altogether? As I mentioned before, there was enough material in the four Gospels for someone to put together one seamless narrative. Why didn't either of these things happen? And what about the passages latched onto by the Arians and the Gnostics we discussed a few minutes ago? Well, were they removed? Well, no, they weren't. They're still there. So, I think like the copying monks we mentioned earlier, the most likely answer to all these questions is that the early Christians regarded the Gospels as sacred texts, the Word of God, spoken through the writers of the Gospels. As a result, they believed that no mere mortal should tamper with them. Indeed, it would be regarded by as the duty of early Christians to preserve these Gospels as accurately as they could, inconsistencies, awkward details, difficult teachings, and all. So, in summary, we saw earlier that the historical analysis suggests that the Gospels were written shortly after Jesus' death. It's therefore likely that they represent a fairly accurate picture of the events of Jesus' life and death as remembered and verified by those who actually witnessed those events. And it would also look like the Gospels we read today are pretty accurate versions of the Gospels as they were originally written. At this point, I'd like to draw our presentation to a close for tonight. I think I probably bombarded you with enough information for one evening. The next part of Jesus the Evidence, we'll spend a short time at the start of the evening concluding our look at historical and archaeological evidence. We'll then spend the remainder of the evening looking at whether the early Christians were correct in believing that Jesus was the Son of God and the Messiah. Did they mistake a first century Jewish teacher, healer, exorcist, and miracle worker for something more than he was? And I guess more importantly, are Christians today making the same mistake? Thanks very much.